Chapter 30, The Sanctuary, God's Dwelling Place in Israel. The command was communicated to Moses while in the mount with God, "Let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them." Full directions were given for the construction of the tabernacle. By their apostasy, the Israelites forfeited the divine presence, but after they were again taken into favor with heaven, the great leader proceeded to execute the divine command. God himself gave Moses the plan of that structure, its size and form, the materials to be employed, and every article of furniture it was to contain. The holy places made with hands were figures of the true patterns of things in the heavens, a miniature representation of the heavenly temple where Christ, our great high priest, was to minister in the sinner's behalf. God presented before Moses a view of the heavenly sanctuary and commanded him to make all things according to the pattern shown him. For building the sanctuary, a large amount of the most costly material was required, yet the Lord accepted only freewill offerings. All the people responded, everyone whose heart stirred him up, and everyone whom his spirit made willing. And they brought the Lord's offering to the work of the tabernacle of the congregation, and they came, both men and women, as many as were willing-hearted, and brought bracelets, and earrings, and rings, and tablets, all jewels of gold. While the building of the sanctuary was in progress, men, women, and children continued to bring their offerings, until those in charge of the work found that they had more than could be used. And Moses caused to be proclaimed throughout the camp, "Let neither man nor woman make any more work for the offering of the sanctuary." So the people were restrained from bringing. The Israelites' devotion, zeal, and liberality are an example worthy of imitation. All who love the worship of God will manifest the same spirit of sacrifice in preparing a house where he may meet with them. An amount sufficient to accomplish the work should be freely given, that the workmen may be able to say, as did the builders of the tabernacle, "Bring no more offerings." The tabernacle was small, not more than 55 feet in length, and 18 in breadth and height. Yet it was magnificent. The wood was that of the acacia tree, less subject to decay than any other at Sinai. The walls consisted of upright boards, set in silver sockets, and held firm by pillars and connection bars, all overlaid with gold, giving the appearance of solid gold. Two apartments symbolize two phases of ministry. The building was divided into two apartments by a beautiful veil, and a similar veil closed the entrance of the first apartment. These were of gorgeous colors, blue, purple, and scarlet, while inwrought with threads of gold and silver were cherubim to represent the angelic host. The sacred tent was enclosed in an open space called the court. The entrance was at the eastern end, closed by curtains of beautiful workmanship, though inferior to those of the sanctuary. The building could be plainly seen by the people without. In the court stood the brazen altar of burnt offering. On this altar were consumed all the sacrifices made by fire unto the Lord, and its horns were sprinkled with the atoning blood. Between the altar and the door of the tabernacle was the brass laver made from the mirrors that had been the freewill offering of the women of Israel. At the laver the priests were to wash their hands and feet whenever they went into the sacred apartments or approached the altar to offer a burnt offering unto the Lord. In the first apartment, or holy place, were the table of showbread, the candlestick, and the altar of incense. The table of showbread stood on the north, it was overlaid with pure gold. On this table the priests were each Sabbath to place 12 cakes, arranged in two piles. On the south was the seven-branched candlestick, its branches ornamented with exquisitely wrought flowers, the whole made from one solid piece of gold. The lamps were never all extinguished at one time, but shed their light by day and night. Just before the veil separating the holy place from the most holy and the immediate presence of God stood the golden altar of incense. Upon this altar the priest was to burn incense every morning and evening, Its horns were touched with the blood of the sin offering and sprinkled with blood upon the great day of atonement. The fire on this altar was kindled by God Himself. Day and night the holy incense diffused its fragrance throughout the sacred apartments and far around the tabernacle. Beyond the inner veil was the Holy of Holies, where centered the symbolic service of atonement and intercession, the connecting link between heaven and earth. In this apartment was the ark, overlaid within and without with gold, a depository for the tables of stone, the Ten Commandments. It was called the Ark of God's Testament, the Ark of the Covenant, since the Ten Commandments were the basis of the covenant made between God and Israel. The cover of the chest was called the Mercy Seat. This was wrought of one solid piece of gold, surmounted by golden cherubim on each end. The position of the cherubim, with their faces turned toward each other and looking reverently downward toward the ark, represented the reverence with which the heavenly host regard the law of God and their interest in the plan of redemption. Above the mercy seat was the Shekinah, the manifestation of the divine presence. Divine messages were sometimes communicated to the high priest by a voice from the cloud. The law of God within the ark was the great rule of righteousness and judgment. That law pronounced death upon the transgressor, but above the law was the mercy seat. By virtue of the atonement, pardon was granted to the repentant sinner. Mercy and truth are met together, righteousness and peace have kissed each other. A dim reflection of heavenly glory. No language can describe the glory within the sanctuary. The gold-plated walls reflecting light from the golden candlestick, the table, and altar of incense, glittering with gold, beyond the second veil the sacred ark, and above it the holy Shekinah, the manifestation of Jehovah's presence, all were but a dim reflection of the glories of the temple of God in heaven, the great center of the work for man's redemption. About half a year was occupied in building the tabernacle. When it was completed, Moses examined all the work of the builders. As the Lord had commanded, even so had they done it, and Moses blessed them. The multitude of Israel crowded around to look upon the sacred structure. The pillar of cloud floated over the sanctuary, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. There was a revealing of the divine majesty, and for a time even Moses could not enter. With deep emotion the people beheld the token that the work of their hands was accepted. A solemn awe rested upon all. The gladness of their heart swelled up in tears of joy. God had condescended to abide with them. In the days of Abraham, the priesthood was the birthright of the eldest son. Now, instead of the firstborn, the Lord accepted the tribe of Levi for the work of the sanctuary. However, Aaron and his sons alone were permitted to minister before the Lord. The rest of the tribe were entrusted with the charge of the tabernacle and its furniture. A special dress was appointed for the priests. The robe of the common priest was of white linen, woven in one piece, confined about the waist by a white linen girdle embroidered in blue, purple, and red. A linen turban or mitre completed his outer costume. The priests were to leave their shoes in the court before entering the sanctuary, and also to wash both their hands and feet before ministering in the tabernacle. Thus was taught the lesson that all defilement must be put away from those who would approach the presence of God. The garments of the high priest were of costly material and beautiful workmanship. In addition to the linen dress of the common priest, he wore a robe of blue, also woven in one piece. Around the skirt it was ornamented with golden bells and pomegranates of blue, purple, and scarlet. The ephod, a shorter garment, was confined by a girdle of the same colors. The ephod was sleeveless, and on its shoulder pieces were set two onyx stones bearing the names of the 12 tribes of Israel. Over the ephod was the breastplate in the form of a square, suspended from the shoulders by a cord of blue. The border was formed of a variety of precious stones, the same that form the 12 foundations of the city of God. The Lord's direction was, Aaron shall bear the names of the children of Israel in the breastplate of judgment upon his heart, when he goeth in unto the holy place, for a memorial before the Lord continually. So Christ, the great high priest, pleading his blood in the sinner's behalf, bears upon his heart the name of every repentant, believing soul. At the right and left of the breastplate were two large stones known as the Urim and Thummim. When questions were brought before the Lord, a halo of light encircling the stone at the right was a token of divine approval, while a cloud shadowing the stone at the left was evidence of denial. Everything connected with the apparel and deportment of the priests was to impress the beholder with the holiness of God and the purity required of those who came into his presence. The sanctuary ministry, a foreshadow of heavenly things. Not only the sanctuary but the ministry of the priests was to serve unto the example and shadow of heavenly things. The ministration consisted of two divisions, a daily and a yearly service. The daily service was performed at the altar of burnt offering in the court of the tabernacle and in the holy place, while the yearly service was in the most holy. No mortal eye but that of the high priest was to look upon the inner apartment of the sanctuary. Only once a year could he enter there. The people in reverent silence awaited his return, their hearts uplifted in prayer for the divine blessing. Before the mercy seat the high priest made the atonement for Israel, and in the cloud of glory, God met with him. His stay beyond the accustomed time filled them with fear, lest because of their sins or his own he had been slain by the glory of the Lord. The daily service. Every morning and evening a lamb of a year old was burned upon the altar, symbolizing the daily consecration of the nation and their constant dependence upon the atoning blood of Christ. Only an offering without blemish could be a symbol of his perfect purity, who was to offer himself as a lamb without blemish and without spot. The Apostle Paul says, "I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that ye present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable unto God, which is your reasonable service." Those who love him with all the heart will desire to give him the best service of the life, constantly seeking to bring every power of their being into harmony with his will. In the offering of incense the priest was brought more directly into the presence of God than any other act of the daily ministration. The glory of God manifested above the mercy seat was partially visible from the first apartment. When the priest offered incense before the Lord, he looked toward the ark, and as the divine glory descended upon the mercy seat and filled the most holy place, often the priest was obliged to retire to the door of the tabernacle. As the priest looked by faith to the mercy seat which he could not see, so the people of God are now to direct their prayers to Christ, their great high priest, who is pleading in their behalf in the sanctuary above. The incense represents the merits and intercession of Christ, his perfect righteousness, which through faith is imputed to his people and which can alone make the worship of sinful beings acceptable to God. By blood and by incense God was to be approached, symbols pointing to the great mediator through whom alone mercy and salvation can be granted to the repentant soul. As the priests morning and evening entered the holy place, the daily sacrifice was ready to be offered upon the altar in the court. This was a time of intense interest. The worshippers at the tabernacle were to engage in searching of the heart and confession of sin. Their petitions ascended with the cloud of incense, while faith laid hold upon the merits of the promised Savior prefigured by the atoning sacrifice. In later times the Jews, scattered as captives in distant lands, still at the appointed hour turned their faces toward Jerusalem and offered their petitions to the God of Israel. In this custom Christians have an example for morning and evening prayer. God looks with great pleasure upon those who bow morning and evening to seek pardon and present their requests for blessings. The showbread was a perpetual offering, part of the daily sacrifice. It was ever before the face of the Lord, an acknowledgement of man's dependence upon God for both temporal and spiritual food, received only through the mediation of Christ. God had fed Israel with bread from heaven, and they were still dependent upon his bounty, both for temporal food and spiritual blessings. Both the manna and the showbread pointed to Christ, the living bread. He himself said, "I am the living bread which came down from heaven." The bread was removed every Sabbath, to be replaced by fresh loaves. The most important part of the daily ministration was the service in behalf of individuals. The repentant sinner brought his offering to the door of the tabernacle, and, placing his hand upon the victim's head, confessed his sins, thus in figure transferring them from himself to the innocent sacrifice. By his own hand the animal was then slain, and the blood was carried by the priest into the holy place and sprinkled before the veil, behind which was the ark containing the law that the sinner had transgressed. By this ceremony the sin was, through the blood, transferred in figure to the sanctuary. In some cases the blood was not taken into the holy place. See, but the flesh was eaten by the priest, as Moses directed, saying, "God hath given it you to bear the iniquity of the congregation." Both ceremonies symbolize the transfer of sin from the penitent to the sanctuary. Such was the work that went on day by day throughout the year. The sins of Israel being thus transferred to the sanctuary, the holy places were defiled, and a special work became necessary for the removal of the sins. God commanded that an atonement be made for each of the sacred apartments, as for the altar, to cleanse it, and hallow it from the uncleanness of the children of Israel. Once a year, on the great day of atonement, the high priest entered the most holy place for the cleansing of the sanctuary. Two kids of the goats were brought to the door of the tabernacle and lots were cast upon them, one lot for the Lord, and the other lot for the scapegoat. The goat upon which the first lot fell was slain as a sin offering for the people. The priest was to bring his blood within the veil and sprinkle it upon the mercy seat. And he shall make an atonement for the holy place, because of the uncleanness of the children of Israel, and because of their transgressions in all their sins, and so shall he do for the tabernacle of the congregation. And Aaron shall lay both his hands upon the head of the live goat, and confess over him all the iniquities of the children of Israel, and all their transgressions in all their sins, putting them upon the head of the goat, and shall send him away by the hand of a fit man into the wilderness, and the goat shall bear upon him all their iniquities unto a land not inhabited. Not until the goat had thus been led away did the people regard themselves as freed from the burden of their sins. Every man was to afflict his soul while the work of atonement was going forward. All business was laid aside, and the whole congregation of Israel spent the day in solemn humiliation before God, with prayer, fasting, and deep searching of heart. Truths taught by Day of Atonement. Important truths concerning the atonement were taught by this yearly service. In the sin offerings presented during the year, a substitute had been accepted in the sinner's stead, but the blood of the victim had not made full atonement for the sin. It had only provided a means by which the sin was transferred to the sanctuary. By the offering of blood, the sinner confessed the guilt of his transgression and expressed faith in him who was to take away the sin of the world. But he was not entirely released from the condemnation of the law. On the Day of Atonement the high priest, having taken an offering for the congregation, went into the most holy place with the blood and sprinkled it upon the mercy seat, above the tables of the law. Thus the claims of the law, which demanded the life of the sinner, were satisfied. Then in his character of mediator the priest took the sins upon himself, and, leaving the sanctuary, bore with him the burden of Israel's guilt. He laid his hands upon the head of the scapegoat and confessed over him all the iniquities of the children of Israel, and all their transgressions in all their sins, putting them upon the head of the goat. As the goat bearing these sins was sent away, they were regarded as forever separated from the people. Such was the service performed unto the example and shadow of heavenly things. The true heavenly sanctuary. The earthly sanctuary was a figure for the time then present, in which were offered both gifts and sacrifices. Its two holy places were patterns of things in the heavens. Christ, our great high priest, is a minister of the sanctuary, and of the true tabernacle, which the Lord pitched and not man. The Apostle John was granted a view of the temple of God in heaven. He beheld there seven lamps of fire burning before the throne. He saw an angel having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. Here the prophet was permitted to behold the first apartment of the sanctuary in heaven. Again, the temple of God was opened, and he looked within the inner veil upon the Holy of Holies. Here he beheld the Ark of his Testament, represented by the sacred chest constructed by Moses to contain the law of God. Paul declares that the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry, when completed, were the patterns of things in the heavens. And John says that he saw the sanctuary in heaven. That sanctuary, in which Jesus ministers in our behalf, is the great original. The sanctuary built by Moses was a copy. Important truths concerning the heavenly sanctuary and the work there carried forward for man's redemption were to be taught by the earthly sanctuary and its services. After his ascension, our Savior was to begin his work as our high priest. Christ is not entered into the holy places made with hands, which are the figures of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. Christ's ministration was to consist of two great divisions, each occupying a period of time and having a distinctive place in the heavenly sanctuary. So the typical ministration consisted of two divisions, the daily and the yearly service, and to each a department of the tabernacle was devoted. Christ at his ascension appeared in the presence of God to plead his blood in behalf of penitent believers. So the priest in the daily ministration sprinkled the blood of the sacrifice in the holy place in the sinner's behalf. The blood of Christ, while it was to release the repentant sinner from the condemnation of the law, was not to conceal the sin. It would stand on record in the sanctuary until the final atonement. So in the type the blood of the sin offering removed the sin from the penitent, but it rested in the sanctuary until the day of atonement. In the great day of final award, the dead are to be judged out of those things which were written in the books, according to their works. Then the sins of all the truly penitent will be blotted from the books of heaven. Thus the sanctuary will be freed, or cleansed, from the record of sin. In the type this great work of blotting out of sins was represented by the services of the Day of Atonement. The cleansing of the earthly sanctuary accomplished by the removal of the sins by which it had been polluted. In the final atonement, the sins of the truly penitent are to be blotted from the records of heaven, no more to be remembered or come into mind. So in the type they were borne away into the wilderness, forever separated from the congregation. Since Satan is the direct instigator of all the sins that caused the death of the Son of God, justice demands that Satan suffer the final punishment. Christ's work for the redemption of men and the purification of the universe from sin will be closed by placing these sins upon Satan, who will bear the final penalty. So in the typical service, the yearly round of ministration closed with the purification of the sanctuary and the confessing of the sins on the head of the scapegoat. Thus in the ministration of the tabernacle the people were taught each day the great truths relative to Christ's death and ministration, and once each year their minds were carried forward to the closing events of the great controversy between Christ and Satan, the final purification of the universe from sin and sinners.